Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. We're the senior staffers of the Libertarian magazine that's preferred by most federal prison inmates. Wake up each Monday and yell at each other about the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and special guest star, Eric Boehm. Let's get ready to rumble, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Matt.
I'm sorry for not mispronouncing your last name, Eric. So, hospitalizations, they're down. Deaths are down. Positive tests, down. And vaccines, totally, crazily way up. It was even spring, I think, last week for about 48 hours. Feels like the fog is beginning to lift, at least on me, because I got the vaccine. President Joe Biden on Thursday gave a somber little pep talk marking the one-year anniversary of Tom Hanks getting COVID and also saying that we're making some real progress and imagining some crazy utopian future in which we might gather in very small groupings of our immediate family wearing masks for the two-year-olds on Independence Day outside. Catherine, President's speech was pretty universally hailed in the mainstream media outlets, since your heart is made out of spare robot parts. I would like you to reflect on the following passage that I'm going to read out loud in quotation marks. Look, we know what we need to do to beat this virus. Tell the truth. Follow the scientists and the science. Work together.
Is he a lyricist for the Doobie Brothers?
First of all,
couldn't even
yes.
do it with a straight face.
Yes. Keep going, Matt. You can do it, baby.
Put trust and faith in our government to fulfill its most important function, which is protecting the American people. We need to remember the government isn't some foreign force in a distant capital.
Really?
No, it's us, all of us. We, the people. For you and I, that America thrives when we give our hearts, when we turn our hands to common purpose. And right now, my friends, we are doing just that. Catherine, are we all heartless, snorkeling, libertarian monsters?
100% yes, of course. No, I was watching this speech alone, and I actually yelled out loud. Like, I made a yelping sound when he said, no, it's us, all of us, because no, it isn't. No, it freaking isn't. And that is wrong. I mean, that passage that you just read is such an incredible example of the thing that libertarians, as well as once upon a time, many conservatives feared, which is the conflation of civil society, of people doing things together, both of which are indeed good, with the state. They are not the same thing. And to claim that they are the same thing is to really fundamentally misunderstand, I think, the relationship between citizens and their government. And to say America thrives when we do things together via the mechanism of government is not the story of coronavirus, first of all. The story of coronavirus is the story of America thriving, in many cases, doing things apart, mandated by government, and doing things successfully, in some cases, in spite of government, or more generously, because on this particular occasion, the government managed to step just enough out of the way to let, for instance, a vaccine be developed and passed through, to let people figure out how to, you know, communicate on the internet via Zoom and other things to continue to do their jobs. The story of coronavirus is a story of overcoming and triumph. It is not a story of overcoming and triumph via the mechanism of the government. And that is a deep, deep misunderstanding of the role of the state.
Eric, I was struck by another Biden passage. He said, quote, in the coming weeks and months, I'll be traveling along with the First Lady, the Vice President, the Second Gentleman, and members of my cabinet to speak directly to you, to tell you the truth about how the American Rescue Plan meets the moment. And if it fails in any part, I will acknowledge that it failed. But he quickly added, it will not. You've written quite a bit about the relationship between the $1.9 trillion Biden stimulus and our quote-unquote moment. Can you assess, using Biden's own professed criteria here, specifically the $350 billion shoveling to state and local governments and a little sneaky provision there about taxes?
Yeah, that's right. I know you guys covered this in length last week, so we don't need to go through like the whole thing Suderman walked through in the podcast last week. But I mean, this is a $1.9 trillion bill that is by and large not a coronavirus stimulus bill or not a coronavirus relief bill. It's not even really a stimulus bill. Even the Associated Press has come out and said it would be inaccurate to describe this as a stimulus bill and its guidance to writers like those of us here. There's all sorts of stuff buried in this legislation that is, again, has nothing to do with the coronavirus, has nothing to do with public health. One of those provisions is this $350 billion bailout to state governments. That's $350 billion, which is much more than most state governments need. It's more than even like progressive groups have been advocating that Congress spend to help bail out state governments. And then there's this other little provision that you mentioned there, Matt, sort of tacked onto this, which says that states that take this money, and it's a little bit murky as to exactly the constitutionality of this, but states that take the money may not be able to change their tax laws in any way for the next few years until 2024. The actual language in the bill says that states, quote, shall not use the funds provided to either directly or indirectly offset a reduction in net tax revenue, or dot, 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 or do anything that, quote, reduces any tax by providing for a reduction in a rate, a rebate, a deduction, a credit, or otherwise, or delays the imposition of any tax or tax increase. So, English version of that, you can't use the bailout money to, you can't, first of all, turn around and take the bailout money and just hand it back to your residents as a sort of tax rebate, which makes some degree of sense. You also can't use that as an offset to, say, create a new scholarship tax program or something that might help school choice. You can't use that as some sort of an offset to pay for or to ease the like reduction in revenue that might come from a broad-based tax decrease, which a few states have been planning, as you know, an actual stimulus measure, right? Like the way to actually stimulate the economy coming out of a recession would be to let people keep more of their own money in their pockets and use it as they see fit. No, can't do that, or maybe can't do that. This will end up certainly being litigated to death if states try to do anything here. But it does appear to give the federal government the ability to basically take states to court for the next few years if they try to do anything that would be considered a reduction in taxes or a rebate or a tax credit program, something like that. If any of the American, and money is fungible, of course, so, you know, what dollars are used for what, who knows. But if any of these bailout dollars are connected either directly or indirectly, the law says, to those tax offsets, states could end up in court.
Once again, I'm struck by how we might have been better served with some journalism about the bill before it was passed, as well as some...
It's an emergency.
It's going to cut child poverty in half, Matt Welch. Didn't you see that journalism? Child poverty.
You just
half.
Stepped am, on my next line, Eric, to Nick, because Nick has to react to another Biden quote as well. Here's what the real man of genius said, Nick. A typical family of four earning about $110,000 will get checks for $5,600. It extends unemployment benefits. It helps small businesses. It lowers healthcare premiums for many. It provides food and nutrition, keeps families in their homes, and it will cut child poverty in this country in half using a saw and this little magic box, according to experts, he says, and it funds all the steps I've just described to beat the virus and create millions of jobs, unquote. Nick, can you handle all that truth?
Yeah, no, I can see that the no malarkey fell off the no malarkey express, and I guess that's the bus now. It's just malarkey all the way down. I think the, you know, a kind of important thing here is what we're witnessing in the first 50 days, you know, 50 days plus of Biden is a consolidation of a move where the government is paying everybody in America a substantial amount of money. You know, they're not paying for it, but they're giving us money. So like Joe Biden talks about a family, an average family of four people making $110,000. That's almost twice the median household income in America. If you're a family of four and you're making $110,000, you probably haven't seen any income loss or very little over the past year. In fact, your savings rates might be up because you're not spending it on anything. And we're now giving people, like in that situation, as well as much higher income levels, money. You know, part of this bill also expands Obamacare subsidies that only phase out on people or households with incomes of $580,000. You know, what is going on in America where we have a massive debt that is compounding every minute of every day, of every month, of every year, and we are just shoveling more and more money to more and more people? Last week, Peter Suderman used the metaphor of what's going on, which I think is a great one, of Ray Liotta in Goodfellas, where he, you know, when he walks into a bar or a club, he's slapping some amount of money. It could be a single, it could be a five, or it could be a 20 or a $50 bill into the palm of everybody he sees. And that is what is going on in America now. And it is bad news because we're already broke. And what we're doing now is just pouring it on in the name of stimulus for an economy that is already growing and is about to grow a lot more as a bunch of what ultimately have probably turned out to be useless coronavirus restrictions are being lifted pretty quickly. So this, you know, we should take note of this simply to say, you know, this is a long time coming. It's not Joe Biden's creation, but he is, you know, he is consolidating trends over the past at least 20 years where the government was just giving out money. And I mean, just to keep it in the 21st century and to be bipartisan about it, George W. Bush, you know, one of the first things he did was pass Medicare Prescription D, you know, which were free or reduced price drugs for wealthy seniors who were not even busting their bank accounts to pay for prescription drugs. You know, we've gone from that to this. And the only question is, where does it stop? You know, does the money flow stop before the economy craters, or, you know, or does it after?
I just want to note that was my very, 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 very first Reason article ever was complaining about that thing that Nick just described. It was
when
like
you were 12 years old.
When I was 12 years old, I wrote an article that was literally like, old people are rich. Stop yeah. giving them stuff.
No, and it was something like the typical Medicare recipient paid 2% of their annual income on prescription drugs. But it was, and Al Gore had campaigned on doing that too. He actually had the cojones to talk about how his mother, and by this point he was a millionaire just from sales of his Earth book. But like was choosing between prescription drugs and her, you know, whether she would eat cat food. You know, it's like what there is a sickness. And I'm willing as the only boomer on the panel to say that there is something really sickening. And Joe Biden, I guess, is, you know, he's like the greatest. He's beyond the greatest generation. He's like, you know, the 1800 class of 1800 quarterback draft or something. But there is something sickening where they, as the leading edge boomers go into their senescence, they are just trying to completely take over the future and make sure that they are ever, they're the big man at the table paying all the bills and taking a lot of that off on themselves as well.
Catherine, to build on one of Nick's points there, which is that the economy is starting to roar. I've seen insane projections over the last week. I've changed up my cable news 90-second diet when I'm up fixing myself lunch, and I go straight only now to CNBC or financial news. I highly recommend it because it's all everything's shooting to the moon, and everyone's like, you know, the inflation's going to come any minute now, and it's interesting to watch. And also Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin 90 trillion projections. But anyways, people are projecting like 8% growth for some quarter in the near future, unemployment down below 4%, maybe 3%, like nuts type of positive things. So after this thing was signed into law, the American Rescue Plan, people are going to be just pointing to the scoreboard, are they not? And saying, look, see, told you this works. So what is your pre-buttal to the inevitable linkage with the $1.9 trillion shovel and the economy, which is going to be good in the second half of this year.
And this is one reason that we keep doing this. This is one reason that we keep dumping huge amounts of money on top of crises, because crises eventually end. And when they end, things get better. And people's brains like to do the cause and effect thing. And so that story sounds quite real. The story of we dumped all this money and then the economy was roaring again. We did it. I will say, in parallel with all these projections of 8% growth and all kinds of stuff, we're also seeing calls for the next stimulus bill. Like, that's the thing that's blowing my mind, is that we are now simultaneously, like, the stimulus worked, the economy is saved, get ready for a wild boom, and we must keep juicing the economy. We must keep dumping more money in, or else we will have failed in our duty to the American citizens to get them through this difficult time. And I think that really highlights what Nick was describing, which is that this whole conversation from the very beginning has conflated some people are genuinely suffering, in part because of state-ordered, mandated closures of their businesses, or because the states that they lived in made it literally illegal to go to work. Those people, maybe, arguably, like, I'm still not sure about it, but, like, maybe deserve a little bit of compensation. There was essentially a takings from them. Maybe they deserve some compensation. That is not at all. 0%. The same thing as, should we forgive $50,000 worth of student loan debt? Does the minimum wage need to be $15 an hour? Does everybody need another check for $1,400 a month, or whatever it is every time? Those are separate questions. And so I think the impending booming economy is going to help a lot of people, including some of the people who were hurt the worst by coronavirus itself and the government restrictions. I do think we are going to continue to see calls for more aid, for more stimulus. And this is, I think, just some basic economics at that point. It's like, don't juice the boom, because the crash is worse. To be a Matt Welsh metaphor mixer.
Total sense to me. I don't.
Don't really juice the boom, because the crash will hurt more and then you can't get back
but
on
your feet.
But
that's
what
this
How's
is, that? Right? This is ultimately a short term.
Leave it all on the field.
Yeah, short term versus long term.
Yeah, 110%.
And the child tax credit is another example of this, or these child subsidies that are now included in the bill is an example of that, right? Like, we're going to pay parents $3,000 a year per kid. And the kids are paying for that. That's all going on the debt that the kids will eventually have to deal with in some way, shape, or form, whether it's just a lower standard of living or whether it's an actual debt crisis down the road. But the parents get the money now, and so that looks really great. To bring it back to the bill that just passed, too, I mean, the amount of money, it was roughly $7 billion. This is a $1.9 trillion bill. There's $7 billion in there for the Paycheck Protection Program, which does the thing that Catherine was just talking about, right? This is the thing that pays businesses to keep people on payroll, even if those people aren't working, until the business can reopen. And we can have, and we have had lots of debates about the libertarianness or appropriateness of that policy. But at least there's a direct connection there, right? Between, like, people can't go to work because of the pandemic, so the government has some role to play in making sure that they can tide businesses and tide people over. But compare that to the fact that this bill also then spends $14 billion, twice as much, creating a new paid family leave program that will only apply to employees of the federal government. So this is, it's not just the olds get rich off the youngs, or the current parents get rich off their kids. It's also the people in power get benefits that the rest of the average Joes in America don't, right? You've had to struggle and juggle a full-time job and being a substitute teacher for your kid. But the federal bureaucrats get now paid to stay home and play substitute teacher for their kid. And that got twice as much funding as the Paycheck Protection Program did. So it's just like the priorities here are all misaligned. And it's all, you know, it's a short-term, long-term thing. And it's a power versus people that aren't in power thing.
Nick, you previously said something nice about Peter. And since he's not on the podcast, that's the only time that we will allow that, because normally you guys are button heads on a few things. But one of the things that Peter wrote about quite a bit during the run-up to the election is that Joe Biden, sure, compared to the field that he was running against, might seem to be in the quote-unquote moderate lane, but his economics are anything but, which he detailed in great length. It's kind of amazing to see how much that has turned true. I was just looking at Drudge for some headlines. You know, you have or Reason for some headlines. You know, Biden tax hike is coming down the pike. Not just the states can't reduce taxes, but now he wants to raise taxes on the federal level. Another headline I saw this morning: Elizabeth Warren protégés spread through the administration. That sounds like it's going to be good. Reflect a little bit about the big government-ness that we are seeing right now.
Well, you know, before the election, I produced a video with the help of Jim Epstein and a couple of other people talking about, you know, the 11 trillion reasons to be sorry that Joe Biden might get elected. And he was, you know, and I expected him to get elected. He's not a moderate. And the Washington Post, you know, of all outlets, said that he was running on the most liberal an expansive, you know, agenda that any major party presidential nominee had ever come up with, which was true. And it's like, yeah, you can say he wasn't going to spend, you know, $40 billion or $40 trillion extra or $65 trillion extra or something that Bernie Sanders did. But he was the nominee and he was promising $11 trillion in new spending over the next 10 years. And he's looking good to deliver on that. You know, the problem with spending and with, you know, massive sustained deficit spending, and even when he gets his tax hike and stuff like that on the way to creating a midterm victory for the Republican Party, because the Democrats are doing exactly the same script that the Republicans did with Bush for a couple of years, that Obama did when he came in with a Democratic majority, that Trump did when he had a Republican majority. I mean, we're going to see a shift in 2022 and or 2024. But beyond the spending, which reduces long-term economic growth, and, you know, we're going to have a great year, enjoy it and spend it because your savings are going to be taxed to pay for all of this in a couple of years anyway. But it's actually that regulatory function, Matt, which I don't think people have necessarily scrutinized enough or thought enough about, because what Biden is doing is throwing a weighted blanket on every aspect of the economy. He and it's not just him. It's the
Democratic
Party.
Is that to help cure the economy's anxiety?
Yeah, it is. You know, we're very anxious, and you know, this is an anxiety, you know, weighted blanket thrown on things like big tech. The Federal Trade Commission is going to start going after. They're going to start checking out everything. And you can dislike Donald Trump intensely. You know, I think that's that's like a default position. That's the human position. But one of the things he did was kind of push through the federal government a general deregulatory aspect to the economy. And the economy, you can't talk about it absent COVID, but his economy was actually doing pretty well. And the people that I talked to who were in businesses that did things that made like FDA devices that need to be cleared by the FDA and other things, were talking about how like it was a relief living under, you know, Trump's administration. It was not necessarily deregulatory, but it was less hawkish on regulation. Biden is going to put in a set of bureaucrats who at every level are going to make people get on their knees, kiss his ring, and beg permission to innovate or to change or to kind of do the types of stuff that will actually create long-term sustainable economic growth.
Catherine, you kind of referenced this earlier, and I always want to give you a chance to do a woohoo about that. Some of the good stuff that's happened over the past year was when government got out of the way and the privates did the private stuff. The people, Catherine, are right now in America getting way more vaccines per capita than just about everyone outside of Israel or the United Kingdom. It's pretty great. And you start looking around. I obviously am thinking a lot about Western Europe and whether my kids can see their grandparents anytime soon. And there, no one's getting vaccinated. And the rates are going up. And they've got curfews at 6 p.m. in France and other places. It's just awful. There's like another wave coming on. So this is an invitation for you to say woohoo about vaccines.
Woohoo about vaccines. I'm happy to say that. Yeah, I mean, I think I actually have been thinking about this a lot, because I do think this is, you know, something that we're experiencing right now is the perks of being a big, rich country. And the other big, rich countries are following our footsteps, and a couple of small, rich ones like Israel as well. we all knew that there were going to be a limited number of vaccines available in the first runs of vaccination, that there was just going to be, you know, this first batch that would come out and they would be more desirable. It is essentially a new iPhone, right? Except for resuming your life. And we were able to negotiate in advance to buy lots and lots of these vaccines. Now, that is, on the one hand, a success of the U.S. government, I suppose. On the other hand, it's a failure of the global market, because I still do think, even though I am happy that I will get a vaccine before justice demands that I get one, let's say it that way, like I need a vaccine a lot less than a lot of other people who are going to be in line after me, globally speaking. But, you know, I have this dream, I have this idea of like, what if there really was a market in these things? What if we really did have a totally open global market that was the tool to allocate these vaccines? That would be better. So I guess, you know, I am like, woohoo, Catherine's going to get a vaccine. But, you know, I was having a conversation with a gentleman who served as both the health minister of Georgia and Ukraine last week at different times. He's pretty interesting dude. And he pointed out that there are no vaccines in Ukraine right now. Like, there are just none. They were not able to purchase any. Presumably some fancy people there are getting them on the black market. But that's it. Like, they just have to wait until another few rounds of vaccines get manufactured and made available. And that's not right. That's not actually correct. Like, the lives of elderly people in Ukraine, they are not worth less. And so I am my American triumphalism here and my absolute delight, again, in the innovation and the rapid manufacture in the vaccine area is tempered by the fact that, you know, I'm talking to my guy, Alexander, not going to be able to say his name, Kvitashvili. Yeah, it's pretty close, maybe. And it was just such a reminder. You know, he basically, as we talked about health policy and innovation in health policy around the world, he just kept saying, I'm not going to include America here. I'm not going to include the United States here because it's such an outlier. Everything there is so weird that it doesn't really give us any insights into what to do in other places. And that's true. This is a deeply weird country that has amazing things about it, including the three vaccines that are available. At the same time, there's a fourth vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, that we have millions of doses of, that we have in a warehouse that are illegal to distribute here. And that
let's let the person who wrote about that talk about that.
Okay. Do it.
Eric. Well, yeah, I mean, right. I think Catherine's exactly right. And I think there's, on one hand, I'm a little bit struck by the kind of lack of appreciation for the sort of exceptional rollout that America has had with the vaccines. On the other hand, yeah, the New York Times reported last week that there's tens of millions of AstraZeneca vaccines sitting in warehouses in Maryland and Ohio, and the Biden administration is not allowing them, at least for now. They're under quite a bit of pressure, apparently, to change this policy, but they are for now not allowing those vaccines to be sent to other countries. Now, the reason why we should send them to other countries is that you can't legally give that vaccine to Americans. The FDA has not approved it. AstraZeneca, in fact, hasn't even gotten to the point of fully submitting all the documentation that the FDA requires to approve it. So it's a bureaucracy issue. On one hand, it's also just they're running slow in getting some of those things done. But a lot of other countries have approved this vaccine. A lot of other countries, their public health officials say, sure, it's fine. There are some questionable issues involving blood clots in Norway that have been identified, but not enough, apparently, when, you know, if you're a country like Ukraine, where you can't get your hands on any other vaccine, this might be the best thing you can do for people who are really at risk in the short term. Brazil has a huge spike in COVID cases at the moment. Their hospitals are at risk of being overrun again. They've approved this vaccine. We should send it there. We should send it to Europe. Obviously, it doesn't make any sense for the United States. It doesn't make any sense for us to hoard vaccines in the first place, period. It certainly doesn't make any sense for us to hoard vaccines that we can't legally give to Americans. Give them to people. Put them in human bodies as soon as possible.
All right. We're going to switch here to the embattled governor of New York in a second. But first, Mark and Carrie have long managed their charitable giving through a national donor-advised fund. But in recent months, that provider went from being a neutral platform to questioning some of Mark and Carrie's grants to conservative causes, even turning down a gift. Fortunately, our disgruntled givers found Donors Trust, a provider that reflects their values. Donors Trust is unique among donor-advised funds because it was built specifically for people who cherish the bedrock values of limited government, personal responsibility, and free enterprise. Donors Trust offers more personalized, nimble service than larger, more bureaucratic providers. As Mark reports, none of the other providers have the ideological element and protection that Donors Trust has. Do you already have a donor-advised fund? You can easily roll that thing over to Donors Trust. The team from Donors Trust works with donors of all levels of giving to protect your charitable legacy and help you achieve your charitable goals. Donor-advised funds are the simple, tax-friendly, secure way to give. Why not work with a fund that matches your values? Roundtable listeners, go get your free donor prospectus at donorstrust.org/reason. You'll be glad you did. Okay, we've talked a lot about over the past few weeks about Nick's very favorite governor, New York's Andrew Cuomo. The latest news is that basically every Democrat in the country who is not named Nancy Pelosi or Joe Biden has called specifically for Cuomo's resignation. Cuomo continues to not resign. I think the number of complaining women now is at six.
Not sure we should. Complaining women isn't quite what you wanted to do there.
Well,
the number of complaining women, first of all, is at all the women. But
okay, there's also reports in the New York Times and elsewhere that Cuomo has had his vaccine czar given phone calls to shore up support, and in the same phone call saying like, "Hey, how's your vaccine supply coming?" Kidding me? Good God.
Doug,
maybe like government czars are a bad idea. I don't know. Just maybe. Yeah. Maybe it's a bad idea.
You know, they worked well in Russia.
Until they didn't.
Catherine, you're a complaining lady. Let's try on this take for a moment here, which is maybe it's good that Cuomo doesn't resign, at least doesn't resign over the particular scandals having to do with sexual harassment in the workplace, because A, you should actually investigate that out and also have legislators take the responsibility of impeachment as opposed to getting the easy ticket of a resignation. And also B, maybe it's okay to have a governor who's totally weak.
First of all, I just want to take a minute and appreciate the word embattled, which is only used like at this moment in it's one of those headline words, right?
Yeah,
it's like
flat.
Embattled governor. And that means like this precise condition that Cuomo is in and that many politicians have found themselves in where they're just kind of screwed and like, but we can't quite say they're out yet. They're embattled. Okay. Right. So I think there is a case for do the impeachment. With Cuomo in particular, I do not mind if politicians have shame and resign. That seems fine. As a general matter, I enjoy my politicians having a little bit of shame occasionally. But in this case, and we've talked about this in the last couple weeks on the podcast, people tipped over on Cuomo on the wrong thing, in my view. All of these allegations of harassment and misconduct are terrible. They certainly keep coming in a way that gives them increasing weight. But the thing Cuomo did really, really, really consequentially wrong was his decision to send coronavirus positive people back, both to nursing homes and to facilities that care for disabled people. And I would like to see an impeachment over that. I would love to see the legislature hold Cuomo accountable and the many people up and down the chain who participated in that decision making accountable in a formal proceeding. Now, even if he resigns, they could still do that. Like that's, you know, as we've seen with Donald Trump, you can continue to do various accountability proceedings up to and including impeachment even after someone has left office. In theory, I don't know the law in New York exactly, but I would like to see accountability for his total failure to manage coronavirus. I think, though, as this story continues to roll out, the thing that we're really seeing is something that lots of New Yorkers have always known, which is that Andrew Cuomo in particular and the Cuomo family in general are the case against political dynasties. They are bullies. They rest on each other's laurels in deeply offensive ways. They enable the growth of government influence through informal networks that are very hard to root out. And it sucks. And we should not keep electing people that have the same last names over and over to our high offices.
And they try to marry Kennedys.
Same last names. Stupid even, last names.
Not even the
you know,
one
you're
good
making
Kennedy.
Me, I mean, when you think, the one thing I think Cuomo has going for him is that he's not part of the Kennedy dynasty anymore.
So I mean, give it
Now I'm reconsidering my contempt for him.
It's like the eternal golden braid. Like, they'll be back.
The worst thing, too, about the coronavirus stuff is that he lied about the figures, or people in his administration lied about the figures. They were reporting fake figures. And that's actually, this is something, I don't want to invoke the cover up is worse than the crime, because that most of the time is not really true. And certainly the fact that people died who didn't have to die because of his orders is bad enough. But, it is stunning that politicians don't understand, like, if you act in good faith and screw up, people can actually deal with that. It is like, then just faking it and lying about it. It's deeply, deeply troubling.
Eric, you are from neither New York nor Nick's California, where Governor Gavin Newsom is hopefully going to face a recall election.
Sorry, he really is Patrick Bateman at this point from American Psycho.
I mean, not just this point.
His character is being revealed slowly.
I don't know if you watched it, Nick, but like he I think it was last week, gave a state of the state address from an empty Dodger Stadium.
Yeah. No,
like, how does that happen
in
your brain?
That's where is the Philly fanatic when you need him to torment
like
somebody in
popcorn,
a Dodger Stadium?
Just a giant bucket of popcorn right on the head.
Don't you think that when they do stuff like that, it's a sign that like the few people around them who were protecting them from their own worst impulses have started to desert them? Like
actively sabotage them? Yeah.
Yeah. Like that Donald Trump statement last week that was just like a bad tweet on quasi-presidential stationery that was like, can everyone please remember that I gave you the big, beautiful shot? And we probably would never have it if not for me. Love, remember me. And it was like somebody sometimes used to stop him from doing that. And like
Trump's
those people
chief of staff now is that kid who was cutting the White House lawn, right? So
yeah, the lawnmower boy.
He's worked through everybody.
I think, Catherine, that the internal saboteur also works for the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, because as Ravi Suavi pointed out on Friday, like not Friday of last year in March, but like Friday a couple days ago, they're like, yeah, totally, even after the vaccinations, two-year-olds need to keep wearing masks. That's someone on the inside saying, okay, listen, we want to make sure no one ever listens to us ever again because we're ridiculous. That's what that was all about.
I was outdoors at a park when I saw that statement, and there was a two-year-old in the park who had removed her mask and was chewing on it. Like, she was like, she had taken it off of one ear and was just chewing on it like it was gum. And I was reading those words and I was like, oh, yeah, CDC, you've really done it. Congratulations.
And they said, like, watch out for playgrounds. Subscriber.
At the risk of just
seriously.
Yeah. At the risk of just going super far afield of this, this brings us back in some ways to like Biden's promise that, oh, you'll be able to get together with other people who are fully vaccinated on the 4th of July. This weekend on Saturday, my alma mater was playing in a conference championship game to go to the NCAA tournament. So I got together with a fully vaccinated friend of mine, but we went to National Harbor right outside of DC. That place was packed. Parking garage was full to the brim. We had to park like down the road in a different garage. The bars were full. The casino, we walked through the casino, every seat that was available to be used. They have some of the slot machines turned off. Full table games, totally full. The sports bar there, full to the allowed capacity. I mean, this whole point, right? That like the CDC's guidelines on this are just being ignored by everybody. Everybody that's not the chattering classes, I think, have completely disregarded this idea, I'm sure.
I want to, before we finish this micro segment, Eric, give you any opportunity to put you on the spot to slime any other governor in the contiguous 48 states.
Oh, like my governor. Yeah, I live in the state of Virginia, so I've still got Ralph Northam kicking around. Yeah, the guy, he was, I frequently refer to him in tweets as former Governor Ralph Northam, just out of, you know, because of it's hilarious to me that he's still the governor.
He was smart enough to be surrounded by people who were as bad or worse.
Yeah, right? Sure. Like the lieutenant governor had some sort of skit. Now I forget the whole thing.
A rape charge against him, and then the attorney general. Also blackface.
Yup. So that's what you got to do, I guess. That's Cuomo needs to move some pieces around to make sure that the people behind him are blackmailable. But that's the guideline for Cuomo, I think, here, right? He's a little more high profile because he's, you know, a Cuomo, and he's the governor of New York State, Virginia. It'll be harder for him to just wait for the spotlight to move on.
And he also dunked on coronavirus. Remember, he published a book about how goddamn great he had the second highest death rate in the country.
And he was
lying about old people killing old people, and he put out that that awful poster.
You know what that book was? When you lie, you're supposed to keep your lie simple because if you talk too much, it makes it like suspicious. that whole book was actually just him doing the giveaway
on another level.
Like, I'm doing a great job. I'm doing a really, really great job.
He was like Kevin Spacey in The Usual Suspects. You know, where it's like, okay, I got to just as long as I keep talking. Yeah. And then I can, if I can make it to the door, I'm
it's
free.
It's been a great couple months.
I thought you meant he was like
though,
Kevin Spacey.
Right?
Like,
yeah. I mean, now he's, where is he? He's probably the third worst Democratic governor in America or something, fourth worst. I mean, he's fallen well down on that list of most hated governors. So good for him.
All you have to do with Ralph Northam is suggest to him, oh, wait, you were really good at doing moonwalk, like a Michael Jackson moonwalk. And he was ready at that one
his
press
wife
conference.
Had to stop him.
To do it,
oh, my
and
God.
And his stupid wife got in the way of what would have been, you know, like a Pulitzer
These
Prize winning photo.
These complaining women just ruining
These
everything.
Absolutely amazing. Complaining women. Catherine.
Oh, my God. I felt that woman's pain. So I remember to watch that clip and she reaches out like, no.
And he looked back. He's like, are you sure? Are you sure I could do it? And like, no. Yeah. She's like, no, honey, no.
Yeah. Let's go to our listener question of the week. Remember, everyone, you can send us your questions via email at roundtable@reason.com or by voicemail at 213-973-3017. Today's great question comes from John, who writes, I've been a fan of Reason for as long as I've been able to understand politics and philosophy. What, so like a week? I'm just kidding. That's a beautiful thing to say. Everyone should throat clear accordingly. You guys are awesome. Love the aesthetic, the magazine, especially in the early days. I don't know much about art and design, but I'd like to take that sort of vibe into my home decor. Yes. Is there a name for it? Are there a few artists you could tell me the names of that might give me some inspiration? I don't mean literally putting Reason magazine on my wall. First mistake there, John. But I want to take inspiration from that look, both the old school retro Reason and the modern Reason that sort of takes inspiration from its heritage of the Friedlander days. If you give me a few names of design styles and artists to Google, I'd greatly appreciate it. John, that's really great. Catherine, why don't you start?
Oh, my guy. I am here for you. I am excited for you to take this decor journey based on the Reason aesthetic. What you are looking for is the Swiss grid, a.k.a. the international typographic style. The word Bauhaus might also be helpful to you, like if you're searching for objects. Don't let me catch you with a serif. There are no serifs in the international style. We do not have little feet on our letters. They just are clean. They get it done. The diva of the typography world that we're talking about here is Helvetica. There's a whole documentary on it. You can go watch it. But the real hero is, and I actually don't know how to pronounce this font, but I think it's Accidens Grotesque, which is, you can Google that. If you can even think about how to spell it. Basically, what we're looking for, though, is Reason was founded in 1968. Our guy, Lanny Friedlander, who founded Reason Magazine, and about whom you can watch a great video narrated by Matt Welsh about the life of Lanny Friedlander and the founding of Reason, has a bunch of photos of him and photos of the early magazine that will really give you a lot of inspiration. I think this is a great choice for you. please send us photos.
Lots of
your
photos.
Design journey.
You know, another kind of phrase for the vibe is a kind of late mid-century modernism in terms of furniture and decor. You can Google just like cheap modernist furniture. Or look at designers like George Nelson, Edward Warmley, Eero Saarinen, Harry Bertoia, and Charles Eames and Jens Rhizom, who are kind of the doyens of interior design-related stuff. Saarinen, Matt, your father had a failed conversation pit, correct?
Yes, very much
yeah.
so.
Yeah, but cool. in the
there
what
is
happened,
no such thing
cool.
as
there,
a failed yeah. conversation.
In
pit,
particularly
Nick,
in the 60s, the kind of space age and modernist, you know, kind of impulse of the international style on the outside and in typography and whatnot, kind of got glitzed up and ironized a little bit, which carried into the 70s, and it's just fun. And the other thing I would say is for the newer stuff, because, you know, under Joanna Andreessen, our current art director, there's a real sense of playfulness and irony. So you take some of that high 60s stuff and then like filter it through the aesthetics of Jim Steranko, one of the great Marvel comic book artists of the mid to late 60s, a kind of psychedelicized and an ironized version of it that ends up in places like Pee-wee's Playhouse and at the Hannah Montana House. It's and the most important thing is to have fun with it.
Yeah, I would add if you start following Nick's advice and going and starting looking for like mid-century modern furniture and stuff, which I recommend. I love the aesthetic myself. We have some cheap jack stuff in our house. Don't go to Palm Springs. Go to Palm Springs because it's great. And it'll give you beautiful ideas to look at. And just Palm Springs in general is always wonderful. But to shop, go to Phoenix. That's my big tip for you people out there. I don't know if it's still true, but last time I paid attention to this stuff, if you wanted your mid-century modern stuff that doesn't know that it's supposed to be expensive, Phoenix, Arizona is the place for you. All right, let's go to our end of podcast. What you have been consuming culturally. Nick, why don't you start?
Sure. I watched the final episode of Alan V. Farrow, the HBO documentary about...
Complaining ladies.
That's the theme of this podcast,
about
isn't
the,
it?
You know, that is, you know, presents the viewpoint of Mia Farrow and her daughter, Dylan Farrow, her son, Ronan Farrow, about allegations that that Woody Allen molested Dylan when she was a young child, which kind of got aired in the early 90s when Woody Allen left Mia Farrow for Suni Previn, who remains his wife, who was an adopted daughter of Mia Farrow's, who was, I think, 20 or 19 or 20 at the time. It is fascinating from a documentarian point of view because it is so biased in presenting only Mia Farrow's case, essentially, that it does a disservice. I tend to, in this, I've read a lot about it, I've watched a lot about it, and I tend to believe that Woody Allen is innocent of the charges of molesting Dylan Farrow. But I could be convinced, but this is a classic case of a story that presents itself. It is so one-sided, it is so sandbagging that it actually removes a lot of doubt rather than kind of making a case presumably the directors wanted. It's kind of fascinating though, as a kind of, you know, it's a four-part documentary. It's a total of about, I don't know, like 5 hours or something. It is well-rendered and all of that, but it is, you know, as a piece of propaganda, as an intervention into a fraught topic, it is a complete failure.
Eric, what have you been consuming?
I think I will just go back a little bit to maybe the best thing that I read during the lockdowns this winter when nobody was going outside. And it's a collection of short stories by Sarah Pinksker, whose novel I think has actually been talked about here on the podcast before as a sort of look at what life could be like post pandemic. But a collection of short stories that she published a couple of years ago called Sooner or Later, Everything Falls into the Sea. And it's just a really terrific mix of like sci-fi genre hopping stuff. In particular, the last story in the collection, which really is somewhat unusual, a little bit different than all the others, and longer, almost like novelette length, which involves a convention, the kind of which we all miss going to, a large gathering of thousands of people, all of whom are different iterations of Sarah Pinsker from different realities, and they have all been brought together voluntarily. They all signed up to do this in an isolated hotel on an island off the coast of Canada for a weekend. And it starts off as like a cool Rick and Morty-esque kind of funny thing about like, oh, why did you become an astrophysicist and I became a bartender and this other person became a private investigator? And then there is a murder that happens. And then it becomes an Agatha Christie story, essentially, in which all the suspects and the victim and the investigator are all different iterations of the same person from different realities. And it's just brilliant. One of the coolest things I have ever read. The whole rest of the collection is also terrific. It's a lot of it has to deal with like the way we create identity for ourselves and sort of cultural identity based on memories and nostalgia. It's sort of sad and thought provoking and also just like brilliantly interesting writing. So sooner or later, everything falls into the sea. Highly recommend.
Sweet. Catherine.
I am recommending a book that was recommended to me by my 10-year-old. This is a first in my house, not that we read it together, but that she read it and said, Mom, I think you would really like this book. You should read it. And I did. And I did.
Wow.
Which is the book Holes by Louis Satcher. Of Wayside Stories from Sideways Stories from Wayside School fame. Just, you know, it's a book for children, but, you know, it is a legitimate novel with very good structure. And it's a kind of great exploration of a thing that I don't think enough kids books really write about, which is like, what do you do when something's off and you don't have a lot of power? And I have that feeling a lot as an adult, actually, but more so as a kid. Something is not right. Some piece of the puzzle is not fitting together, and you got to figure out what's up. It is a mystery, but it's also just an exploration of the weirdness of the world and sort of realizing that the world is weirder and darker than you thought it was. Which is something that 10-year-olds are ready for, but apparently 40-year-olds are also ready for. My main reflection upon reading it, I think because of the books that I read adjacent to it, is that Louis Satcher is the Otessa Mashvega of the kindergarten set, or of the elementary school set, or maybe the other way around, I guess, since he came first. But they share a kind of sense. I've talked about her work on this podcast, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, Eileen, Homesick for Another World. They both share this sense of like, what if the world is just like gross and messed up underneath? And there's a version of that for all ages. So I recommend to you, as my daughter recommended to me, Holes by Louis Satcher.
There's a fantastic movie version of that as well. Highly recommend it.
Maybe we will attempt a Welshian family movie night.
It's really, really good. It's as good as the book in many ways.
I queuing up Nick's snorting noises. I watched the Grammy Awards in their entirety last night, ladies and gentlemen. There we go. Which Eric was admitting pre-podcast. This is the first time in 15 years he has not watched the Grammy Awards. I'm here to tell you, Eric, you made a mistake. Which is that they actually adapted the awards themselves to the times in a way that was pretty interesting. Not just like the piano note and like essential workers are the real heroes. They did a little bit of that, but it wasn't that much. They have leaned much more even than in previous years to like, this is just not even an award show. I think they gave out two or three maybe. It was just all like live music, and they thankfully front loaded the good live music at the top of the show, so I could sort of nod off during the Cardi B stuff at the end, which wasn't very interesting. I like Cardi B, but I didn't find what she did interesting. But
you were drunk by then, Matt Welch.
That's
or sober. I don't know.
That's the proper way to consume Cardi B live performance, I think.
Exactly. So I watch the Grammys for three reasons now. One is obviously to the in memoriam part, which this year was especially long, as you can imagine, and poignant. A lot of tremendous artists died, but this is, since I'm okay boomering this, this is what we increasingly watch it for. But I also watch it to bond with my daughter and have her make fun of me. And especially every year, there's always one artist that's like, hey, that was good. Who's that? A couple years ago, it was Brandi Carlile, who also played a really nice John Prine song last night. But last night, it was a band from L.A. that I should have heard about years ago called Haim.
They're so good. Matt Welch, come on.
Those ladies?
It's Sister Act. Yeah, they look like they're about like 12, but they're in their 30s, and this is their third record, and it was nominated. And they're all multi-instrumentalists and fun, just like pop rock. With a little 70s kind of thrown in, but just
the final evolution of Hanson.
Kind of
the trans version of Hanson.
No, you know come on. Haim is so much better than that. That's
first of all,
cutting Hanson's
how
growing near enough.
So,
Bop says no.
Second, their bangs situation alone is worth like being a fan, but their music is great. I did tune in for the Taylor Swift. I watched just the YouTube of the Taylor Swift bit because I'm a white lady and that's required by law, of her just like languishing on moss for some reason for a while.
This was pointed out on the Twitters that she's just become a Tolkien character at this point.
I love it.
She's just in Hobbiton playing with the dudes from the National, you know, winning and winning and winning some more. But yeah, it's just all green moss and silliness. But yeah, Haim. Cantor's Deli, they got a Paul Thomas Anderson video of one of their first songs. That's pretty good. And they like make a lot of silly little YouTube videos that are actually very charming. Like them. You should check them out.
Something to Tell You is the name of their album that came out a few years ago now, probably 3 or 4 years ago. It's not their most recent one. Women in Music Part 3 is their most recent one. Also very good, but Something to Tell You is phenomenal. Go listen to that right now.
Awesome. That's what I want to
hear. Can I take a moment to attack Bill Burr on the Grammys?
Yes, please do. Please do.
Because that's from Twitter, looking at Twitter last night. That was what was showing up most of my feed. It's the way that Bill Burr, you know, he gets it, and he attacked white women again while giving an award for Latino music. And it's like he is the biggest pussy when it comes to attacking political correctness, because he never goes after Black Lives Matter or anything like that. He only goes after white women. And it's just kind of like, wow, that's a brave statement, a brave, brave, brave statement.
I guess I appreciate that he exists.
Can't we
as
give
a category?
Massachusetts, yeah, just give Massachusetts back to England or Canada or France or wherever it came from.
I got enough mass holes in my life. I don't need to actually
give it back to the Indians.
All right. Are we all canceled because of this, or just like three out of the four of us?
I think Eric,
it's my podcast
Eric
now.
Is a guest. He's a guest in our home. He can't be blamed for this conduct.
Thank everyone for listening. Check out all of our stuff at Reason.com podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. And the Soho Forum with Gene Epstein et al. Hopefully, if the world still exists, we'll see you next Monday. All right. Bye-bye.